Blog Talk Radio.
This next story is a short story from the Repartee magazine. Do you ever wonder what those guys in the cockpit are
talking right now? I hit the wrong button. I do this all the time now. I think the older I get, the more confused I am with running this show. Been doing it now for about 14, 15 years. I can't remember which, but anyhow, it seems like 100 years. But we have fun doing it anyhow with mistakes and everything. So, and I've got my good buddy, Captain Jim Harris, out there in Dripping Springs, Texas. Jim, say hello.
Hello, greetings and salutations. This is Jim Harris in Dripping Springs, Texas. A good place to live. I'm about 15 west of Austin.
Okay. Austin City Lights. Is that the name of I've heard of Austin City Lights. What is that?
Actually, Austin City Limits. Austin City Limits. Yeah, it's where they do a lot of live music.
Okay. All right. Austin City Limits. So,
yeah, Austin City Limits.
So it's a TV show or a radio show? Which is it?
TV.
It's like a concert, like a Grand Ole Opry, that type of thing?
No, it's just people. They have various guests in, and they sing, pick and grin.
Okay.
Yeah, they do a little pick and grinning.
Okay, folks. Here we are again. It's Saturday, August the 24th. My little calendar here on my computer says, and we're in the showtime here. So we're originating from my studios in my home, which is in the World Golf Village here in St. Augustine, Florida, beautiful city. If you've never been to St. Augustine, you ought to come. It's an old city. It's been around for a long, long time. Some people say it's the oldest city in the U.S. So before it gets too old, why don't you come see us? And anyhow, we do the radio show right here at the World Golf Village in St. Augustine, Florida. And our antenna is way up there, 22,000 miles up in the air. And I don't know how that works either. A lot of things I don't know how it works. But anyhow, I just kind of accept it. And you can listen to us if you're on the other side of the world, because we got 50 countries plus listening to us from time to time. We've identified 50 countries around the world. And China, Russia, some of those countries that I don't know what they're gaining. They might be gaining some kind of secret information we're putting out here over the radio. I don't know. But at any rate, we got a lot of countries that tune us in. So it's because of that antenna way up there at 22,000 miles up in the air. And you can go to our server, Blog Talk Radio, that puts us on the air sometimes, because we've had a lot of problems with them here lately. Sometimes it works about halfway through the show and cuts us off, or sometimes it doesn't even come on because they're having technical problems. But let's see how long we can last with them today. But at any rate, they're they're doing the show for us, and we sign on. And we've been doing this, like I say, 14, 15 years. We've had a lot of hosts that's been with us over the years. We've been scripted. But now we're doing things just kind of talking and non-scripted. But we do have some readings that we have been recording here. And Harry Lindquist and his beautiful wife, Linda, have recorded along with me. And I'm trying to get Jim Harris to do some recording out there in Dripping Springs. So maybe he can do some and you hear a different voice. But we got a couple of stories we're going to run by you and maybe talk a little bit about those stories after they're finished and see how you like them and what we can talk about with them. But first one here is called Chicken or Steak. Chicken or Steak. I don't know who did this one. It might have been Harry, but I think it's probably Linda's going to be telling us about chicken or steak. That sounds like me. It might be a flight attendant story. What do you think, Jim Harris? You think it is chicken or steak?
I think so.
Now, you told me a joke about chicken or steak. What was the successful trip? Don't you tell that story now.
I don't believe I'll tell that.
Okay. All right. Let's hear what this chicken or steak sounds like. It's about 3 minutes, and then we'll talk about what was said. Here it goes.
This next story is a short story from the Repartee magazine. Do you ever wonder what those guys in the cockpit are doing prior to takeoff? We know they're figuring gross weights and fuel loads and wind and weather and V1 and V2. But sometimes they're also concerned with some more mundane things like what are we going to have for dinner this evening? This story is entitled Steak or Chicken? A true short story. Names are withheld to protect the guilty. As dusk fell on the old Atlanta terminal, known for its turquoise and orange accent panels and modern design supplanting the old hangar building located in the northwest Atlanta of KATL, the Eastern DC-9 front-end crew had just settled down for a crew meal prior to departure from an outlying gate serviced by a motorized jetway. It was dark outside when the senior asked who would have what. The boss chose steak, and the co-pilot was relieved to have the chicken, since after several years of exposure, had etched a rude neural pathway into his reptilian brain. The overhead lights were doused, and the trays were brought to sit kingly on our laps with map lights to guide our knives and forks. Also, the cockpit door was pulled closed but not locked, since passengers were beginning to board for the flight to who knows where. Silence dominated the ingestion for several minutes until quite suddenly a tinkle and clatter erupted from the left seat and the right seater thought he saw a tray flying up into the glare shield while dishes and implements flew in all directions. The first officer was concerned and both parties immediately responded to the emergency first aid training gratefully received some unknown time ago during recurrent training. Without a word, both attempted to stand up in the limited space between their seats and position themselves in a way that the boss would be facing forward with the FO directly behind him to initiate the revered Heimlich maneuver. All was going well despite considerable jostling to achieve the necessary fist of the second party and the first party's lower sternum to facilitate a vigorous expelling of the offending chow of rubberized gristle masquerading as steak. At the very moment of expiration and expelling following the third vigorous gut punch, both parties lost their combined balance, falling backwards against the cockpit door, which immediately sprung open, allowing the passengers to skitter away from the two large crewmen who were obviously in fierce disagreement over some unknown issue and fell to the boarding area floor as the captain belched forth a gray blob and sung out, "I'm saved. I'm okay now." With that, the senior was seen to roll her eyes and say something to the effect that boys will be boys, and the passengers again attempted to find their way into the airplane amid the pilots finding their way back into the dark of the wizard room they had just successfully evacuated from. Shortly, the captain explained via the PA system that training and quick thinking had saved the day and his bacon, and all was peaceful up front with the seat belt, no smoking signs on, and a thank you for flying Eastern. This was submitted by Big John Schur, who was the first officer. This next story is a short...
Well, that's before we get to the next story. Before we get to the next story, if I were a passenger, if I'd seen what was going on in the cockpit, I certainly would have made a U-turn and walked back down that jetway, got off that airplane. But see, the cockpit crew looked like a wrestling night on television. But at any rate, boy, that must have been something. I'm going to turn your microphone back on, Jim Harris. I heard some background noise there. But if you're back with
He's here.
Yeah, have you ever choked on the food of Eastern, been trying to feed you some good food, steak or whatever, and choked on it?
No, never did. I never did.
I never did either. I've had.
It wasn't the best in the world, but it's certainly better than nothing.
Oh yeah. Well, we had some mighty fine dinners when we were serving the great restaurant flights. You remember those flights? I don't think I've ever owned one of those,
but we, whenever you fly out to L.A., they had some really good stuff left over for the first taste factor, so F.A. should often bring us some of that good stuff.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I like their chicken cordon bleu. I love that chicken cordon bleu with that cheese in the middle of it.
I wasn't real fond of it, but it was you know, certainly better than nothing going hungry.
It was good, yeah. And then they gave us I remember at one time, didn't we get sandwiches in a box? Crew meals? They served passengers.
I don't think I ever had that.
Well, I think there was a short period of time they tried that out. But now they're giving peanuts. I guess they're still giving peanuts and pretzels. But Coke probably have to buy them. But at any rate, that must have been something for Big John. And he's a big guy. He kind of reminds me of Burl Ives. And he plays a mean guitar, too, and sings. Great singer. Plays a good guitar. He's on the board of directors of the Retired Eastern Pilots Association. And we saw him a few months ago when we went to Atlanta for one of the last meetings they had for the Retired Eastern Pilots Association, which is now no longer. So at any rate, we also had a very famous aviator that some of us got to meet. Didn't fly with him, but I did see him, like you were mentioning, Jim. You had the occasion to meet him. But Dick Merrill, Captain Dick Merrill, but he was very famous. He started out, and he was number two on a seniority list, and Captain Gene Brown was number one for years and years because they were Mayo wing pilots. They flew the Mayo when Eastern first started up. And so let's hear what they got to say about Dick Merrill here. I don't know. I guess Harry might be doing this one. Here we go.
I thought it might be interesting to learn a little more about one of Eastern's most famous aviators, Captain Dick Merrill. Henry Tyndall Dick Merrill was born February 1st, 1894, in Iuka, Mississippi. He died October 31st, 1982, at the age of 88. He was an early aviation pioneer. Among his feats, he was the highest paid airmail pilot, flew the first round-trip transatlantic flight in 1936, was Dwight D. Eisenhower's personal pilot during the 1952 presidential elections, set several speed records, and would go on to be Eastern Airlines' most experienced pilot with over 36,000 hours until his retirement in 1961. In total, Merrill flew over 45,000 hours as pilot in command, covering over 8 million miles. At a time when record-breaking pilots were treated as celebrities, pioneer aviators like Dick Merrill gained a unique status. His most famous flight was a 1936 round-trip transatlantic flight that has gone down in the annals of flight as a ping-pong flight. The following year, Merrill also completed the first commercial transatlantic flight. He was born in 1894 in Iuka, Mississippi. He was born into a family that prided itself as being descended from the famous frontier pioneer Daniel Boone. Although his full name was Henry Tyndall, the name Dick was a childhood moniker that stuck with him for life. Brought up as a devout Catholic, he was a teetotaler in an age when the hard-drinking, fun-loving aero-adventurer was seen as a norm. considered very easygoing yet serious. His one foible, however, was that he was an inveterate gambler throughout his life. Merrill had from an early age been intrigued by the exploits of the first flyers, and when he enlisted in World War I, he began learning to fly while stationed in France, but returned home to work on the Illinois Central Railroad as a fireman. He began his aviation career in earnest when he purchased a war surplus Curtiss JN-4 Jenny in Columbus, Georgia in 1920 for $600, flying into their shows through the 1920s, briefly appearing with the Ivan Gates Air Circus in the mid-1920s. He eventually turned this into a career as an airmail pilot, flying the Richmond to Atlanta night route. By 1930, Merrill held the record for flying the longest cumulative distance and became the highest paid airmail pilot, earning $13,000 in 1930 at 10 cents per mile. Eddie Rickenbacker later called him the best commercial pilot in the United States. Unlike some of his peers, Merrill was a deliberate and careful pilot, so well regarded that many celebrities, his friend Walter Winchell and even General Eisenhower during his 52 presidential campaign, specifically requested him as a personal pilot. Merrill would always chalk up his successful flights more to luck than skill. A later compatriot, Merton Meade, related an anecdote that summed up Merrill's flying luck. Dick often said he'd rather be lucky than good. When Eddie Rickenbacker owned Eastern, he always insisted on Dick flying the airplane whenever he had to travel. Dick always told the story, "But Captain, you've got 100 pilots on the line better than me." "I know, Merrill, but you're the luckiest son of a bitch I've got, and I'd rather fly behind a lucky pilot than a good one any day." Typical selfie-facing comment by Dick. I doubt there was ever a better airline pilot than Dick Merrill. Now here's about the famous ping-pong flight. He had planned his transatlantic flight for some time, but was unable to finance it or on his pay as an Eastern Airlines pilot. Things changed when he met millionaire singer Harry Richman, famed for putting on the Ritz. After taking in the singer show in Miami, Merrill planted the idea for a round-trip flight of the Atlantic. He brazenly declared that they take the plane to Europe, then will gas her up and fly back. It's never been done. Richman, who had recently gained his pilot's license, had been able to secure a Volte V1A capable of making the flight. The aircraft, NC-13770, had originally been built for Lieutenant Colonel George R. Hutchinson's proposed off-rate New York-London-Moscow airline, which never started up. Since then, it had served a number of pilots in various record-setting flights. In 1935, Jimmy Doolittle used the aircraft to make a record 11-hour, 59-minute transcontinental flight, and 6 weeks later, Leland Andrews repeated the flight, then used it to set a long-distance speed record between Los Angeles and Mexico City. Merrill and Richman extensively modified the Volte V1A for the flight. Using Eastern Airlines mechanics, Merrill had extra fuel tanks installed and a 1,000-horsepower Wright Cyclone with a two-blade constant speed prop fitted. The most modern equipment was sought out, including the Hooven radio direction finder. Licensed to Bendix, it was Richman's idea to fill empty spaces in the wings and fuselage with 41,000 ping-pong balls, which was hoped would allow the aircraft to float if it was forced down in the ocean. After modifications were carried out, they took off for London on September 2, 1936. The two aviators were an odd couple, with Richman flamboyant, while Merrill was always a studied professional. In a later interview, Merrill revealed a peculiar predilection to perfume. When flying, he usually had a vial of Surrender or Evening in Paris in his pocket, stealing an occasional sniff over the Atlantic. When they were 600 miles off the coast of England, the pair ran into bad weather and eventually decided to put down in Llandilo, Wales, about 175 miles west of London. The flight took 18 hours and 36 minutes, the fastest Atlantic crossing to date. The next day, Merrill and Richman completed their flight to London. While in England, Richman, ever the showman, christened the Volte the Lady Peace. On September 14th, they began the return flight from Southport, England. During the flight, while bucking headwinds, Richman decided to dump 500 gallons of fuel, leaving them with insufficient fuel to make New York City. Furious that Richmond had panicked, Merrill was forced to put down on a soft bog at Musgrave Harbor in the Dominion of Newfoundland. After minor repairs and fueling, a week later they landed in New York. The usually easygoing relationship between the two pilots had been strained, but they ended up as friends again. The round-trip flight cost Richmond $360,000 and is known in aviation history as the ping-pong flight. Richmond sold autographed ping-pong balls from the flight for years. And that'll be the conclusion of part one of the Dick Merrill story. This article was taken from Wikipedia. Stay tuned for part two.
Okay, now, Jim Harris, what do you think of that?
That's a very interesting story. I'd never heard that before.
Well, you know, the question is, if they went down, you think those ping pong balls would have floated that airplane? And how long do you think that the airplane would have stayed above water with the ping pong balls?
Well, I think with the ping pong balls displaced in any water, yeah, it would have floated, I think.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I think it would have too. I don't know for how long, but at any rate.
Well, I think indefinitely, as long as they had ping pong balls in there, they displaced the water.
Yeah,
and,
that's true.
I think it would float.
Yeah, they could have, yeah, that might have worked. They could have used tennis balls too, I guess.
I guess. ping pong balls are a lot lighter, so that's probably why they use those.
Well, you know, Merrill was a very interesting person, and he married a beautiful woman. She was a movie star, and I think she was at the end of the non-talkie movies and then entered into the talkie movies. But she was a gorgeous woman, blonde, and her name was Toby Wing. Now, after Dick had passed away, I had taken my children out to Los Angeles to go to Disney and Universal and all of the, you know, the entertainment they have out there in L.A. And so I got a pass, and we didn't travel. It wasn't a trip for me, just like a little vacation. And during that flight, we happened to see at Universal the guy that was on Gunsmoke. I forgot his name, but the guy had a limp. Do you remember his name?
Yeah, it was Chester.
Chester, yeah. We saw Chester.
Yeah.
And then we, on the way back, over at the TWA terminal, that was where we had our flights originate from.
Yeah, that's right. That's where all of our stuff originated from.
Yeah, my daughter went over to the candy area concessions stand there, and she wanted to buy some candy. She didn't have quite enough money to buy it. So she was this guy standing beside her. Now, mind you, my daughter here, she must have been about 10 years old, 11 years old. This guy was standing beside her, not much taller than her. And he said, how much do you need? He asked my daughter. And she said, I don't know. And he looked at and asked, and it was a dime that she was short. So he gave her a dime, and she got her candy, and she walked away. And I said, did you get something? She said, yeah, I didn't have enough money, but that man over there paid for it, a little bit of it. And I looked over there, and she was pointing directly at Mickey Rooney. Can you believe that? Mickey Rooney. Yeah. And like I say, he wasn't much taller than her, but, and then when we got in the airplane, they set us up in first class. And it wasn't, it was my son and my daughter. And we all sat in first class. And at any rate, this beautiful woman was sitting in the seat right in front of me. And I said, now, I told my daughter, we've seen the guy from Gunsmoke, Chester, that you mentioned his name. I remember it now, Chester. And we saw Mickey Rooney. I said, do you know who that lady is sitting in front of us? And my daughter looked over, and she said, no. And I said, that's a movie star, too, and her name is Toby Wing. Dick Merrill's wife was sitting in front of us. And if you've never seen Toby Wing, you ought to go to the internet and just type in her name, T-O-B-Y-W-I-N-G, Toby Wing, and you'll see a beautiful lady. And Dick was married to her, and he even did a movie, I think. She had a movie that was done by Dick Merrill, and I forgot the other Eastern pilot, but they did a movie together. But at any rate, he was an interesting person. And, you know, when he was flying the Mayo, you remember he used to have some pets that he flew along with him. He had that squirrel that he trained to sit on his shoulder in an open cockpit, open air cockpit. And when he was flying the Mayo, he took his squirrel along with him. And then he graduated up to a dog, I think. And then he got a lion. You remember the lion that he trained as a cub? And he carried that lion in the cockpit with him. And so an interesting person.
Interesting character.
Yeah, yeah. So, and you said that you met him at one time?
I did. I met him somewhere, and I don't remember where, but somehow, you know, he was a big show-off.
Yeah.
He liked to talk and show off. And somewhere I met him, I don't even know where I met him, but I remember him. You know, Mickey Rooney had a famous wife, too, Ava Gardner.
That's right. That's right. He was married to her.
He's married to Ava Gardner.
Ava Gardner.
Every man's heartthrob out there at one time.
Yeah. I think Frank Sinatra dated her, too, didn't he?
He probably did. I don't remember that, but it's certainly possible.
Yeah, I have to look that up. Well, we got another story here by Dick Merrill, but I'm going to skip that one, and I'm going to go right straight to a story that you may remember. It was operated by with the Electra aircraft, and it was during the Cuban era, and it was called the Cuban Air Lift when Castro was getting everyone out that he didn't like, that didn't agree with him, and we were flying him over to Miami. So this is a story that was told by Steve McDonald, Captain Steve McDonald, and was in the Repartee magazine, I think. So this is not a long story, but I think it's quite interesting. Let's listen to the Cuban airlift.
This story comes to us from Eastern Captain Steve McDonald. It's entitled Eastern's Cuban Airlift. We started the regular schedule to Cuba shortly after Electras were brought back to the Miami crew base to fly Miami, Nassau, and Miami Freeport, called the Bahamas Express. There was also a daily Miami, Vero Beach, Ocala, Gainesville, Jacksonville turnaround with a 3-hour and 59-minute layover in Jacksonville. It was truly the junior trip on the bid sheet. I would guess the Bahamas Express started with a Section 28 about spring of 1970. We must have got the contract away from PA at Pan American because the service to UVR started up about the same time. We were not flying the Cuban airlift prior to spring of 1970 that I know about. Electras were used earlier and only specifically to retrieve passengers that had been involved in hijacking. Castro would not let the hijacked plane fly the passengers out of Jose Marti, Havana. Instead, he had them bused to Varadero, where we sent rescue Electras to pick them up for return to the USA. I flew two of those rescue flights with Bill Bowers and Jack Williams to Varadero in fall-winter of 1969. The two stewards both spoke fluent Spanish and had 60 years combined service with EAL. I suspect, like the pilots, it was not a bid thing, but an assignment from the office. Ford Smith, Sandy's son, was number one co-pilot when the Bahamas Shuttle Express started and he flew the Cuban airlifts. As he and a few others moved on, I eventually became number one co-pilot, getting DC-8 bypass pay for flying the Electra. What a deal. 100% foreign to boot. I was there until the end of the Electra flying in Miami of 1973. Art Dunlop was boss, but we rarely saw him flying. Tommy Tompkins was assistant boss, and he was everywhere. He was hard-headed, but had a prankster streak in him. If you did your job, you got along with Tommy. Likely as not, you'd be the brunt of one of his pranks. So we reciprocated.
We had our own ramp service guys who, like us, bid for the Bahamas Express and were specifically assigned. The one main agent assigned was Jack Howard, who was a real prankster. He must have worked overtime 7 days a week because he was always there to meet or dispatch the flight. Dispatch release papers were usually at the departure gate and rarely in operations. Mechanics were not specifically assigned, as I recall. We exclusively used gates D1 and D3 at Miami for the Bahamas and Jacksonville flights. The Cuban airlift plane was always an Electra parked away from the terminal. The customs and immigration guys let us bring back Cuban cigars and other stuff we purchased in the UVR terminal. Of course, they were also doing that. I brought a box of Romeo and Juliet or Monte Cristo cigars home almost after every flight and gave them to friends or for presents. I wasn't a smoker. The same Cubana agent handled us all the time, so we got to know him. As the final flight day approached, Tommy told the agent to put anyone on the airplane that wanted to go. The Cubana agent did not quite understand, so Tommy told him, if 150 people want to get on that plane, load them because Castro would never shoot down the last flight. Tommy also told the agent to get his family and himself onto the plane as they were welcome. When we arrived for the last flight, the agent was in tears because he wanted to go with us, but he couldn't get his family past the guards. One of the similarities amongst all the flights except the final flight was that there was no luggage for the 80-plus passengers we carried day in and day out. The baggage carts awaiting our plane might have 5 or 6 bags total every flight. The final flight was a complete surprise. The baggage carts were jammed full of luggage for this flight, and the passengers, instead of looking like the usual prison inmates, were dressed in Palm Beach suits and evening dresses. And I mean pre-1958 Palm Beach suits. It was a stunning array to watch these people boarding the plane. They were obviously quality, wealthy people who had bought their way out of Cuba on the last flight. Our non-airlift recollection was that Cruzquez called me one day and asked if I wanted to fly a charter to the Berry Islands with Burt Beach. Higginbottom was taking some of his buddies fishing for the day. It didn't appeal to me, so I declined, and pal Charlie Combs got the trip. They landed at Chub Cay. Bert was taxiing in. The ground crew signaled Bert for a sharp right turn. Bert looked at the close-by palm trees and stopped, signaled the ground crewman that Bert thought the trees were too close. Ground crew goes over and looks at the wingtip and gives Bert a thumbs up. Crash, got the wingtip. And Higginbottom was furious. Another plane had to be dispatched, and Bert's plane had to have a ferry crew. Those guys were stuck all day in Chub Bay in uniform with no place to go.
Well, that was an interesting story. Did you know Steve McDonald, Jim Harris?
Yeah, I didn't know him well. I knew him. I knew who he was whenever I saw him.
Yeah, he was one of my first hosts on the radio show, and he was a historian for the radio show for a while and submitted a lot of these stories to me, and I posted them on the website, the EAL radio show website, which is no longer up. But I did manage to take a lot of those stories, including the one you just heard that Steve had written. About his flight. You flew the Electra, I think. Didn't you tell me that you started out in the Electra?
I was a flight engineer on the Electra for 2 years.
Okay. Did you like that airplane?
I did. It was a great airplane. I got, all the captains were junior, so I used to get to steal some time.
Oh, okay.
It was a great flying airplane. I flew this like a 172 or something.
Yeah, it
was. I enjoyed flying it.
Yeah, I came off the Convair when I first started with Eastman. Was on the Convair 440, and I remember the Electra also picked up the flight from the flight that I used to fly from Washington to Miami on the Convair, flight 687, and we used to go through Jacksonville and down to Gainesville, Ocala, and all, and then I think the lecturer took over that flight that Steve had in his report there that we just heard. And but it was a good airplane. I enjoyed flying it, and captains like Hassan Callaway let me have some flying time as well from the flight engineer. Kurt Whaley was another good guy. He flew the right seat, and Hassan there were so many guys I enjoyed flying with.
Everybody.
Yeah. So the great airplane, and I don't know I forgot how long we flew that airplane, but it was a shuttle flight airplane for a long, long time until it was replaced by the 9s and the 727s. Of course, it replaced the Constellations, the Electra did, on the shuttle flights up in New York and Washington.
Yeah, they did. Uh-huh.
Yeah. But, yeah, it was a good airplane. I really enjoyed flying that airplane. And
there was one thing I wish I would have done to get some recip time in to fly the Martin or the Convair.
Oh,
I should have done that.
Yeah, I flew that for 1 year, the Convair, the 440. And when I transferred from Washington to Atlanta, that's when I went on the Electra. And that was a year after I was hired. But the Convair 440, I love that airplane. As a matter of fact, the guys that were in my class that lucked out and got, I think half of my class got the Convair, and some of them went to Charlotte and New Orleans on the Convair, and I went to Washington, D.C., but we all enjoyed flying that airplane. It was a great airplane.
Oh, it's bound to be fun to fly.
And that was the first big engine, radial engine I ever flew. I worked on them as a mechanic, before Eastern. But that 2800 was a fantastic engine, and R2800. Let's see.
Yep.
Here's an interesting one. It's not very long, I don't think. But at any rate, I've got this one that will tell you what it's all about and see if you remember this.
Car 54, where are you? Car 54, where are you?
Okay, Car 54, where are you? And I used that to record this story about an Eastern Airplanes that was lost. And the captain was Bill Pappy. You probably flew with Bill Pappy as well, I'm sure.
Yeah.
From Atlanta. So here's his story. Here's his story about having a 727 lost.
Airplane 851, where are you? This story is written by Captain William or Bill Pappy. It was March 9th, 1984, and I had just checked in at Atlanta for a three-day sequence. All that was scheduled on this day was a nonstop Atlanta to Providence leg, followed by a 12-hour layover. The forms agent advised that Atlanta maintenance wanted to know if we would test hop the plane scheduled for the trip. As most remember, test hops were voluntary, and I discussed the request with the first officer, H. Gilbert, and the second officer, A. Harvey. Both agreed to do it, and I phoned the maintenance supervisor. He told me that the plane was just out of the hangar where a pressurization problem had been corrected, but Miami wanted a test flight flown before any passengers were carried. He added that the plane was on the gate, fueled, and ready to go. Second Officer Harvey went to the gate and asked the forms agent for the paperwork for the flight. It had been given a flight number of 2301, but there was no flight plan in the papers. When questioned about the flight plan, the agent said that neither he nor the computer filed flight plans for test hops. Well, that's no big deal. We can just get Atlanta Approach Control to let us fly in their airspace while doing what we needed to do quickly return. We met Second Officer Harvey in the jetway, and he told us that a man from engineering was going to go and accompany us. In the forward galley stood a guy in a coat and tie with a briefcase and a clipboard. He explained that he needed to see the airplane at flight level 370 and that he had his two-page checklist of items to go through with Second Officer Harvey. The list included shutting down the AC packs, that's the air conditioning packs, and lots of other stuff. Well, so much for a little spin around the pattern in Atlanta. We need to file a flight plan of some kind in order to do this, and we need to do it now. The forms agent had already told me that he has no dealings with flight plans of this kind, so I figured it was up to me to just get it done. I went into the gate area and phoned Atlanta Flight Service and told the briefer that I wanted to file an IFR flight plan. The briefer said that he was ready to copy, and I launched off November 851EA, a Boeing 727/A, true airspeed 475 knots, departing Atlanta in 25 minutes, requesting flight level 370, and gave him a requested route of flight to Jacksonville and back to Atlanta. I told him to put in the remarks section that no landing would be made in Jacksonville, and finished all the required information that included my name, address, and my phone number, and hung up. Back in the cockpit, we did the checklist. First Officer Gilbert told Atlanta Clearance Delivery what was going on, and we soon had the clearance for November 851EA in hand. Engines were started. We powered back and were on our way to nowhere at flight level 370. Since this was no regular flight and Second Officer Harvey was busy with the engineer, none of us called in, out, or off times to the company. None of us monitored the company radio frequency as into the night we climbed while the guys in the back were working their way through two pages on that clipboard. About three-quarters of the way to Jacksonville, it was decided we could head back to Atlanta while the remainder of the checks and tests were completed. Back on the ground in Atlanta, Second Officer Harvey called for a gate. "Where have you guys been?" was the response. Just as we cleared the gate area, a decision had been made to use another airplane for the Atlanta-Providence flight, and the company had been trying to get ATC or anybody to contact us and tell us to return. We did not answer calls on the company frequencies, and ATC had no record of an Eastern 2301 on any of their frequencies because we were on file as November 851EA. Plain old November 851EA, a Boeing 727/A, being flown by some guy from Gainesville, Georgia, who usually filed flight plans for a white and red Comanche 250, we had quite simply disappeared with aircraft 851 to parts totally unknown for 1 hour and 35 minutes. Anyway, since we had been found, we were to get to the gate where our aircraft had been fueled, pre-flighted, and loaded with the people. We hurried to the gate, and after a brief explanation to the passengers about where their mystery flight crew had been, we were off and had a nice flight to Providence. Airplane 851 had also successfully completed a very thorough test of its pressurization system, and I never heard a word about why I had disappeared for over 1.5 hours with a Boeing 727.
Now, Jim Harris, you probably would have taken it to Dripping Springs, wouldn't you?
That'd be fun. Oh yeah. Yep. There's a runway out west from here, a few miles. It's big enough for a 727.
Well, you said something about somebody wanting to put a 727 back in the air, and you were going to fly it.
Oh yeah, yeah. A friend of mine likes propane. Oh yeah, a friend of mine likes propane a whole lot. His name is Henry Harness. I said the smartest doggone guy I know of. I'm just glad he knows my name. Anyway, he wants to fly a 727 on propane. So I plan on using the two outboard engines, put them on kerosene. The middle one going to put it on propane. So he wants somebody to fly this stupid thing. So, yeah, I'm going to do it.
Oh,
it ought to be fun.
Wonder where he's getting the airplane.
There's plenty of them in the boneyard out in Tucson, so I guess that's where he's going to do it.
Well,
I haven't. I need to get some more information from him to see what all he's when he's planning on doing this, but
wow.
It ought to be a fun thing to do.
Well, I don't know. Are either terrifying on propane?
Well, if you know a 727, if you ever get in there, it'll fly on one engine, so you don't want it to.
Well, maybe you can run a special line from that propane tank there and put a grill in there and start charcoaling. I mean, propaning some steaks on the way.
Yeah, that's right. I'd like to do that.
Well, Bill Pepe was an interesting guy to fly with. He was a lot of fun.
I know it. And I remember him.
Yeah.
I think he lived on the lake, didn't he?
He did. He lived up on Lake Lanier. And
yeah.
I flew with him a lot. He was quite something. He was very young to have checked out, when he did. And but he had that airplane, that Comanche airplane. I remember seeing it when John and I kept our steerman over at Gainesville, Georgia Airport there, and Bill Pepe had his Comanche 250 there. But interesting folks. Well, that was a pretty good show. That's about all the stuff I've got pre-recorded. You got anything else you want to talk about, Jim?
I'm thinking. All I know is we had some very interesting characters to operate with. It was so much fun. It was truly so much fun. Well, this is a kind of a funny story. One of our captains, of course, I won't mention any name. He was kind of a pain in the butt to fly with, but he was all right. He was a good pilot. But anyway, on this particular day, I knew who it was, so I made sure I got out to the airplane. I was co-pilot. Got out the airport at least more than enough time. I got the clearance, and I'm sitting there waiting on him. He got on the airplane. So whenever he did was tashed, I said, "Any special instructions, Captain?" He said, "Now, why did you say that?" I said, "Sir, if I know that you operate by the book, strictly, and I just want to let you know that I do too." So, yep, I had him right there.
Yeah.
It was a fun trip. God, I loved it. It was so much fun.
Yeah. I remember flying with guys like Mark Britt. And,
oh, I love Mark Britt. Yeah.
Oh, you know, and he looked like he was 100 years old. But believe me, you know, those guys, they were less than 60. And yet when I recall all of the guys that I flew with, when we had to retire at 60, they sure didn't, you know, they looked older than 60. Don't you think?
Yeah, I do too. Mark Britt smoked a lot.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
He told me,
I got first time I ever flew with Mark, got in the airplane, 727, got in the airplane, and he told me, he said, "Now you take care of everything on your side of what's above you, and down between the two of us," he said, "you take care of everything on the checklist on that side of yours, and I'll take everything on my side of it." And he said, that's the checklist. Make sure you get everything. In other words, I wanted to
okay.
read the checklist, and he told me this is the way we're going to do it.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
He told me, he said, "I kind of run a loose cockpit." And boy, he did. And
it's so loose, it wasn't anything to it.
Yeah, and I remember he owned that airport out there at the bottom of Stone Mountain, and he used to call it Stone Mountain International Airport, and it was
yeah.
out there. Yeah, a little old small strip out there. And but we did have some characters. I mean, so many of those guys. And I don't think they talk about you or me like we talk about them.
You know, somebody landed on top of that at rock there, Stone Mountain.
Yeah. Yeah, that was, golly, I can't even think of his name now. But he was an air mail pilot, and he landed on top of it and carried his mail, walked his mail down, and down the side of the mountain. But he left the airplane up there. And what was his name? Golly, Pete, I can't think of it. As soon as we go off the air, I'll remember it. Because that was
Yeah, well, you can tell us next time.
Yeah, there you go. And we got some more stories that we'll do this again next week. And this was a lot of fun, Jim.
Oh, yeah. I used to fly with G.L. Glenn Fielding a lot.
Yeah.
Remember
Glenn
him?
Fielding.
G.L. Fielding.
Yeah, I remember. He was a neighbor of mine. We lived out there in Indian Hills. Yeah.
Yeah. We had this trip, Atlanta, Montgomery, Pensacola, Mobile, New Orleans, Huntsville, Atlanta. Damn thing scheduled for 7:59. And, of course, we always went over. But it was one day on and 4 or 5 days off. It was an excellent trip. He was a fun guy to fly with. And of course, he smoked. And this is kind of a funny story, too. That I didn't know this, but there's 20 matches in the book of matches. There's also 20 cigarettes in a pack. So he always had to wind up with equal numbers of each. I think we had some character, and we still, we had some great characters.
Well, I remember Jack Tack. I don't know if you ever flew with Jack. But he was, by the way, a lot of people didn't remember it, but during World War II, he was an ace. He had shot down. He had over 5 kills. Enemy kills, and he was, you had to have 5 to be called an ace.
Oh, yeah.
And he was also shot down and stayed in a raft out there until he was discovered. I think he had a P-40, and that was in the Pacific Ocean. But Jack would smoke those cigarettes, and the ash became longer than the cigarette. And he could sit there and talk to our air traffic control, and I just knew that thing was going to fall. So
yep.
I don't know whether he put some kind of glue on those ashes as he smoked down, because they seemed to never want to fall off the end of that cigarette.
Hey, another guy did that too. Was A.P. Edmonston, Paul Edmonston.
Yeah, Paul. He did that too.
Smooth mouth Paul. What a character.
Yeah. And a lot of those guys that smoked, of course, they had burns in their ties and in their shirts.
Oh, yeah.
Where ashes did fall and burn through.
Oh, yeah.
But these were great guys to fly with. And let's come back and do it again next week, Jim, if you don't mind.
Okay.
I'm going to sign off. And my wife and I are going to go out and do something. I don't know what we're going to do. It's Saturday afternoon.
It is.
The rain has stopped outside, so at any rate, I'm going to put this on and see if you can, where is it? Golly, Pete, I don't guess I...
Silver Wings, I suppose.
No, I'm going to use a funny one that I found.
Okay.
That I thought was really good.
I can't never look to Silver Wings whenever you play the thing, because I'll be singing the thing the rest of the day.
I know it, me too. So let's listen to Porky Pig.
That's all, folks.
And that's all, Jim. I'll see you next week.
Hey, listen, thank you so very much for doing what you do. I appreciate it so much.
As long as we can have fun, we'll keep doing it.
Oh, it's going to always be fun. I'm going to make sure of that part.
Okay. I'll see you next week, Jim.
Thank you, buddy. Bye.